Pride, Ambition. Have you ever considered what it is to be successful as a writer, as a poet, as a painter, as a businessman or politician, to feel that you have inwardly achieved a certain control over yourself, which others do not have, or that you succeeded where others have failed, to feel that you are better than somebody else? That you have become a successful man, that you are respected, looked up to by others as an example. What does all this indicate? Naturally, when you have this feeling, there is pride. I have done something. I am important. The feeling of I is in its very nature a sense of pride. So pride grows with success. One is proud of being very important. Compared with other people. This comparison of yourself with another exists also in your pursuit of the example, the ideal, and it gives you hope, it gives you strength, purpose, drive, which only strengthens the I, the pleasurable feeling that you are much more important than anybody else. And that feeling, that sense of pleasure, is the beginning of pride. Pride brings a great deal of vanity, an egotistic inflation. You can observe this in the older people and in yourself. When you pass an examination and feel that you are a little cleverer than another, a sense of pleasure comes in. It is the same when you outdo somebody in an argument, or when you feel that you are physically much stronger or more beautiful. Immediately, there is a sense of your own importance. This feeling of the importance of the me inevitably brings conflict, struggle, pain, because you have to maintain your importance all the time. Suppose I am proud because I have achieved something. I have become the principal. I have been to England or to America. I have done great things. My photograph has appeared in the newspapers, and so on and so on. Feeling very proud, I say to myself, how am I to be free of pride? Now, why do I want to be free of pride? That is the important question, not how to be free. What is the motive? What is the reason? What is the incentive? Do I want to be free of pride because I find it harmful to me, painful, spiritually not good? If that is the motive, then to try to free myself from pride is another form of pride, is it not? I am still concerned with achievement. Finding that pride is very painful, spiritually ugly, I say that I must be free of it. The I must be free contains the same motive as the I must be successful. The I is still important. It is the center of my struggle to be free. So what matters is not how to be free of pride, but to understand the I, and the I is very subtle. It wants one thing this year and another thing next year, and when that turns out to be painful, it then wants something else. So as long as the center of the I exists, whether one is proud or so-called humble, is of very little significance. They are only different coats to put on. When a particular coat appeals to me, I put it on. And next year, according to my fancies, my desires, I put on another coat. What you have to understand is how this I comes into being. The I comes into being through the sense of achievement in various forms. This does not mean that you must not act, but the feeling that you are acting, that you are achieving, that you must be without pride, has to be understood. You have to understand the structure of the I. You have to be aware of your own thinking. You have to observe how you treat your mother and father, your teacher and the servant. you have to be conscious of how you regard those who are above you and those who are below you, those whom you respect and those whom you despise. All this reveals the ways of the eye. Through understanding the ways of the eye, there is freedom from the eye. That is what matters, not just how to be free of pride. We have heard people say that without ambition, we cannot do anything. In our schools, in our social life, in our relationship with each other, in anything we do in life, we feel that ambition is necessary to achieve a certain end, either personal or collective or social, or for the nation. You know what the word ambition means? To achieve an end, to have the drive, the personal drive, the feeling that without struggling, without competing, without pushing, you cannot get anything done in this world. Please watch yourself and those about you, and you will see how ambitious people are. A clerk wants to become the manager. The manager wants to become the boss. The minister wants to be the prime minister. The lieutenant wants to become the general. So each one has his ambition. We also encourage this feeling in schools. We encourage students to compete, to be better than somebody else. All our so-called progress is based on ambition. If you draw, you must draw much better than anybody else. If you make an image, it must be better than that made by anybody else. There is this constant struggle. What happens in this process is that you become very cruel. Because you want to achieve an end, you become cruel, ruthless, thoughtless, in your group, in your class, in your nation. Ambition is really a form of power, the desire for power over myself and over others, the power to do something better than anybody else. In ambition, there is a sense of comparison, and therefore the ambitious man is never really a creative man, is never a happy man. In himself, he is discontented. And yet, we think that without ambition, we should be nothing. We should have no progress. Is there a different way of doing things without ambition? A different way of living, acting, building, inventing, without this struggle of competition in which there is cruelty and which ultimately ends in war? I think there is a different way. But that way requires doing something contrary to all the established customs of thought. When we are seeking a result, the important thing is the result, not the thing we do in itself. Can we understand and love the thing which we are doing without caring for what it will produce, what it will get us, or what name or what reputation we will have? Success is an invention of a society which is greedy, which is acquisitive. Can we, each one of us, as we are growing, find out what we really love to do, whether it is mending a shoe, becoming a cobbler, or building a bridge, or being a capable and efficient administrator? Can we have the love of the thing in itself without caring for what it will give us or what it will do in the world? If we can understand that spirit, that feeling, then I think action will not create misery as it does at the present time. Then we shall not be in conflict with one another. But it is very difficult to find out what you really love to do, because you have so many contradictory urges. When you see an engine going very fast, you want to be an engine driver. When you are young, there is an extraordinary beauty in the engine. I do not know if you have watched it, but later on, that stage passes, and you want to become an orator, a speaker, a writer, or an engineer. And that too passes. Gradually, because of our rotten education, you are forced into a particular channel, into a particular groove. So you become a clerk, or a lawyer, or a mischief monger. And in that job, you live, you compete, you are ambitious, you struggle. Is it not the function of education, while you are very young, to help to bring about such intelligence in each one of you that you will have a job that is congenial to you and which you love and want to do, that you will not do a job which you hate or with which you are bored, but which you have to do because you are already married or because you have the responsibility of your parents or because your parents say that you must be a lawyer when you really want to be a painter? Is it not very important, while you are young, for the teacher to understand this problem of ambition and to prevent it, by talking it over with each one of you, by explaining, by going into the whole problem of competition? This will help you to find out what you really want to do. Now, we think in terms of doing something which will give us a personal benefit, or a benefit to society, or to the nation. We grow to maturity without maturing inwardly, without knowing what we want to do, but being forced to do something in which our heart is not. So we live in misery. But society, that is, your parents, your guardians, your friends, and everybody about you, says what a marvelous person you are, because you are a success. We are ambitious. Ambition is not only in the outer world, but also in the inner world, in the world of the psyche and of the spirit. There also we want to be a success. We want to have the greatest ideals. This constant struggle to become something is very destructive. It disintegrates. It destroys. Can't you understand this urge to become and concern yourself with being whatever you are, and then, from there, move on? If I am jealous, can I know I am jealous or envious, and not try to become non-envious mentally? Jealousy is self-enclosing. If I know I am jealous and watch it and let it be, then I will see that out of that something extraordinary comes. The becomer, whether in the outer world or in the spiritual world, is a machine. He will never know what real joy is. One will know joy only when one sees what one is and lets that complexity, that beauty, that ugliness, that corruption act without attempting to become something else. To do this is very difficult because the mind is always wanting to be something. You want to become philosophers or become great writers. You worship the god of success, not the thing that is. However poor you may be, however empty, however dull, if you can see the thing as it is, then that will begin to transform itself. But a mind occupied in becoming something never understands the being, the understanding of the being of what one is. That brings an extraordinary elation, a release of creative thought, creative life. All the religious books, all our education, all our social, cultural approaches are to achieve, to become something. But that has not created a happy world. It has brought enormous misery. We live with ambition. That is our daily bread. But that bread poisons us, produces in us all kinds of misery, mentally and physically, so that the moment we are thwarted and prevented from carrying out our ambition, we fall ill. But a man who has the inward feeling of doing the thing which he loves, without thinking of an end, without thinking of a result, that man has no frustrations. He has no hindrances. He is the real creator. Ambition and interest are two different things, are they not? If I am really interested in painting, if I love to paint, then I do not compete to be the best or the most famous painter. I just love painting. You may be better at painting than I, but I do not compare myself with you. When I paint, I love what I am doing, and for me, that is sufficient in itself. If the mind is in a state of comparison, it creates problems and is everlastingly caught in them, and therefore it is never free. From childhood, we have been brought up to compare the Greek architecture, the Egyptian, the modern, to compare with the leader, the better, the more cultured, the more cunning, to be the perfect example, to follow the master, to compare, 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 and therefore to compete. Where there is comparison, there must be conflict and contradiction, obviously, which means ambition. Those three are linked together inevitably. Comparison comes with competition, and competition is essentially ambition. And yet, you know, every society is based on this competition. The more, the more, the more, the better. The world is caught up in it, and every individual is in it. We say that if we have no ambition, if we have no goal, if we have no aim, we are just decaying. This is so deeply rooted in our minds, in our hearts, this thing to achieve, to arrive, to be. Now, is it possible to see the process of this conflict? The very perception of this conflict, perceiving, seeing the very source of this conflict, not what you should do about it, has its own action. Now, do we see that? That is all I am asking. What is the good of saying it is inevitable? What will happen if I don't compete in the society which is competitive, which is ambitious, which is authoritative? What will happen to me? That is not the problem. You will answer it later. But can we see the fact that a mind which is in conflict is the most destructive mind, and whatever it wants to do, any activity, however reformative, has in it the seed of destruction? Do I see it as I see a cobra, that it is poisonous? That is the crux of the whole matter. And if I see it, I do not have to do a thing about it. It has its own action. Why discuss everything else? How to build character? What should you do and what should you not do? And how can we find it? Surely, to uncover the source of love, the mind must be extraordinarily free from conflict. So, can the mind be free from conflict, which means competition and all the rest of it? Perhaps if we can go into the question of initiative, then there may be a possibility of understanding self-fulfillment. For most of us, fulfillment in some form or other becomes urgent, becomes necessary. In the process of fulfilling, so many problems, so many contradictions, so many conflicts arise, and there is everlasting misery in fulfillment. And yet, we do not know how to escape from it, how to act without fulfilling. For in the very fulfillment of action, there is sorrow. Action is not merely doing something, but is it not also thinking? Most of us are concerned with doing something, And if that action is satisfactory, if it sufficiently guarantees the fulfillment of one's desires, cravings, longings, then we are easily pacified. But if we do not discover the incentive that lies behind the urge to fulfill, surely we shall always be haunted by fear, with frustration. So is it not necessary to find out what this incentive is that is driving us? It may be clothed in different paints, with different intentions, with different meanings. But perhaps if we can hesitatingly, tentatively explore this question of incentive, then we shall begin to understand an action or a thought which is not always born from this consciousness of fulfillment. Most of our incentives spring from ambitions, from pride, from the desire to be secure or to be well thought of. Now, you may say, or I may say, that my action is the outcome of the desire to do good, or to find the right values, or to have an ideology, a system that is incorruptible, or to do something that is essentially worthwhile, and so on. But behind all these words, all these pleasant-sounding phrases, is not the motive, the urge in some form or another, ambition? I want to achieve, I want to arrive, I want to have comfort, to know a certainty of mind in which there is no conflict. My incentive is to achieve a result and to be assured of that result, in the same way as the man who accumulates money and who also seeks security. So in both these forces, there is the drive, which we call ambition, upon which all our activities, our outlook, our energies are spent. Is it possible to act without these ambitions, without these desires to fulfill? That is, I want to fulfill through my nation, through my children, through property, through name. I want to be somebody. And the pride of being somebody is extraordinary, because it gives extraordinary energy without doing anything. Merely the sense of being proud in itself is sufficient to keep me going, to keep me resisting, controlling, shaping. You watch your own minds in operation. You will see the activities, and you will see that behind them, however much you may cover them up with pleasant words, the drive is for fulfillment, for being somebody, to achieve a result. In this drive of ambition, there is competition, ruthlessness, and our whole structure of society is based on that. The ambitious man is looked upon as being worthwhile, as being somebody who is good for society, who will, through his ambition, create a right environment, and so on, and so on. Or we condemn ambition when it is worldly. We do not condemn it when we call it spiritual. A man who has given up the world, renounced it, and is seeking, he is not condemned. Is he not also driven by ambition to be something? Every one of us is seeking fulfillment. Fulfillment through ideas, fulfillment through capacity, fulfillment through release in painting, through writing a poem, in loving, in being generous, in trying to be well thought of. So are not all our activities the outcome of this urge to fulfill? And behind that urge is ambition. When I hear that, when I know that, and when I realize that where there is fulfillment, there must be sorrow, what am I to do? Do you follow what I mean? I realize my life is based on ambition. Though I try to cover it up, though I suffer, though I sacrifice myself for an idea, all my activities are an outlet for self-fulfillment. You see me burnt out, and you set yourself to do something worthwhile. That worthwhileness is still the urge for fulfillment. This is our life. This is our constant urge, our constant pursuit, conscious as well as unconscious. When I realize this, when I know the content of all this struggle, what am I to do? This urge to fulfill is one of our most fundamental problems, is it not? This urge to fulfill is in little things and in big things. To be somebody in my house, to dominate over my wife, my children, and to submit myself in the office, in order to rise, in order someday to be somebody. So that is the process of my life. That is the process of all our lives. Then how is such a mind to put aside the desire for fulfillment? How am I to free myself from ambition? I see that ambition is a form of self-fulfillment, and where there is fulfillment, there is always the sense of being down and out, of being broken, frustrated. There is fear, a sense of utter loneliness, of despair and everlasting hope. Is there any activity, any form of movement of the mind, which is not based on this? If I brush aside, control, shape ambition, it is still ambition, because I say, it does not pay me to do this, but if I do that, that will pay me. If I say I must not fulfill, then there is the conflict of not fulfilling, the resistance against the desire, and the very resistance against the desire to fulfill becomes another form of fulfillment. Why is the mind seeking fulfillment? Why is the mind, the me, which is the thought, why is it proud, ambitious? Why does it want to be well thought of? Can I understand that? Can the mind realize what it is that is pushing outwardly all the time? And when the outward movement of consciousness is cut, then it turns inward, and there again it is thwarted. So our consciousness is this constant breathing in and out, to be important and not to be, to receive and to reject. This is our daily life of consciousness. And behind it, the mind is seeking a way out. If I can understand that, can know its full significance, then perhaps it is possible to have action which is not of ambition, which is not of pride, which is not of fulfillment, which is not of the mind. To seek God, to try to find God, is another form of pride. And is it possible for me and you to find out what it is that is making us continuously go out and come in, go out and come in? Are we not aware of a state of emptiness in us, a state of despair, of loneliness, the complete sense of not being able to depend on anything, not having anybody to look up to? Don't we know a moment of extraordinary loneliness, of extraordinary sorrow, without reason, a sense of despair at the height of success, at the height of pride, at the height of thought, at the height of love? Don't we know this loneliness? And is this loneliness not pushing us always to be somebody, to be well thought of? Can I live with that loneliness, not run away from it, not try to fulfill through some action, and not try to transform it, not try to shape and control it? If the mind can, then perhaps it will go beyond that loneliness, beyond that despair, which does not mean into hope, into a state of devotion. Can I understand and live in that loneliness, not run away from it, but live in that strange loneliness which comes when I am bored, when I am afraid, when I am apprehensive, not for any cause or with cause. When I know this sense of loneliness, is it possible for the mind to live with it without trying to push it away? Please listen to this. Do not just listen to the mere words. As I talk, if you have observed your own minds, you will have come to that state of loneliness. It is with you now. This is not hypnosis, because I suggest it, but actually, if you have followed the workings of your own mind, you will have come to that state of loneliness, to be stripped of everything, every pretense, every pride, every virtue, every action. Can the mind live with that? Can the mind stay with it without any form of condemnation? Can it look at it without interfering, not as the observer looking at it? Is not then the mind itself that state? Do you follow? If I look at loneliness, then the mind operates on the loneliness, tries to shape it or control it or run away from it. The mind itself, not as the observer, is alone, lonely, empty. It cannot tolerate for a single minute a state in which it is completely empty, a state in which it does not know, a state in which there is no action of knowing. So a mind, seeing that, is fearful of it. It runs away into some activity of fulfillment. Now, if the mind can stay in that very extraordinary sense of being cut off from everything, from all ideas, from all crutches, from all dependences, then is it not possible for such a mind to go beyond, not theoretically, but actually? It is only when it can fully experience that state of loneliness, that state of emptiness, that state of non-dependency, that it is possible to bring about an action which is without ambition. Then only is it possible to have a world in which there is no competition, no ruthless pursuit of self-enclosing activity. Then that action is not the action through the narrow funnel of the me. That action is not self-enclosing. You will find that such an action is creative, because it is without motive, without ambition. It is not seeking a result. But to find that, must the mind go through all this? Can it not suddenly jump? The mind can jump, if I know how to listen. If I am listening rightly now, without any barrier, without any interpretation, with an open door to discover, there is freedom, and through freedom alone I can discover. That freedom is the freedom from fear, the freedom from being well thought of, the freedom from pride, the freedom from the desire to fulfill. And that freedom cannot come about except through the realization of the complete negation of all thought. When the mind is totally empty, lonely, when the mind is in a state in which there is neither despair nor fulfillment, then only is there a possibility of a world in which ruthlessness, brutality, competition can come to an end. The psychological structure of society is what we are, what we think, what we feel, the envy, the ambition, the everlasting struggle of contradiction, both conscious and unconscious, and we are caught in that. To break through it, we think we must make a great deal of effort. But effort always implies conflict, contradiction, does it not? When there is no contradiction, there is no effort. You live. But there is contradiction brought about by the psychological structure of the society in which we live. There is a conflict, a battle going on within each one of us all the time, consciously or unconsciously. And I feel that until this whole psychological structure is completely understood and broken through, we cannot possibly live a full life or understand that which is beyond the mind. You see, the world is becoming more and more superficial. There is increasing prosperity throughout the world. There is the welfare state, and great progress is being made in many directions. But inwardly, we have remained more or less static, pursuing the same old patterns, the same beliefs. We may alter our dogmas occasionally to suit circumstances, but we are living our lives very superficially. We are always scratching on the surface and never going below. And however superficially clever we are, however much knowledge or information we may have about so many things, until we alter completely, deep down, the whole psychological structure of our being, I don't see how we can be free and so be creative. So I would like to consider with you this evening how to bring about a revolution, a psychological revolution, without effort. I am using the word effort in the sense of striving, trying to achieve or become something, of a mind that is caught in contradiction, that is struggling to overcome, to discipline, to conform, to adjust, to bring about a change within itself. I am using the word effort to cover all that. Now, is it possible to bring about a total revolution without effort, not only in the conscious mind, but also deep down in the unconscious? For when we make an effort to bring about a psychological revolution within ourselves, it implies pressure, influence, a motive, a direction, all of which is the result of our conditioning. Our conditioning, conscious and unconscious, is very deep and heavy, is it not? We are Christians, Hindus, Englishmen, Frenchmen, Germans, Indians, Russians. We belong to this or that church with all its dogmas, to this or that race with its burden of history. Superficially, our minds are educated. The conscious mind is educated according to the culture we live in. And from that, one can perhaps disentangle oneself fairly easily. It is not too difficult to put aside being an Englishman, an Indian, a Russian, or whatever one happens to be, or to leave a particular church or religion. But it is much more difficult to uncondition the unconscious, which plays a far greater part in our life than the conscious mind. The training of the conscious mind is useful and necessary as a means of earning a livelihood or to perform a certain function, which is what our education is mostly concerned about. We are trained to do certain things, to function more or less mechanically in a certain way. That is our superficial education. But inwardly, unconsciously, deep down, we are the result of many thousands of years of man's endeavor. We are the sum total of his struggles, his hopes, his despairs, his everlasting search for something beyond. And this piling up of experience is still going on within us. To be aware of that conditioning and to be free of it demands a great deal of attention. But to go very deeply into oneself, one must obviously be free of ambition, of competition, of envy, greed. And that's a very difficult thing to do, because envy, greed, and ambition are the very substance of the psychological social structure of which we are a part. Living as we are in a world made up of acquisitiveness, ambition, competition, to be entirely free of these things and yet not be destroyed by the world is really the problem. If one observes, one is aware of how rapidly knowledge and technology are advancing in the world. Man will soon be able to go to the moon. Computers are taking over, and we ourselves are becoming more and more like machines, more and more automatic. Many of us go to the office day after day and are thoroughly bored with what we are doing, so we seek to escape from that boredom. And religion is a marvelous escape. Or we turn to various forms of sensation and to drugs in order to feel more, to see more. This is going on throughout the world. We are in perpetual conflict, not only with ourselves, but with others. All our relationships are based on conflict, on possession, on acquisitiveness, on force. And when the mind is caught in such conflict, in such despair and anxiety, I don't see how one can go very far. But one has to go far. One has to destroy the whole psychological structure of society within oneself, destroy it completely. That is really the crux of our existence. Because we do lead a most superficial life, and we try to penetrate deeply by reading, by acquiring knowledge, by gaining more and more information. But all knowledge, all information, is always on the surface. So the question really is, how is one to live in this world without bringing about conflict, outwardly and especially inwardly? Because the inward conflict dictates the outward conflict. Only a mind that is really free of conflict at every level, because it has no psychological problems of any kind, only such a mind can find out if there is something beyond itself. Essentially, our problem is not how to make more money, or how to stop the hydrogen bomb, or whether to join the common market. Such problems are not very deep. They will be shaped and controlled by economic factors, by historical events, and by the innumerable pressures of sovereign governments, of societies and religions. What matters is to be capable of abstracting oneself from all that, not by withdrawing, not by becoming a monk or a nun, but by actually understanding its whole significance. One has to find out for oneself if it is at all possible to be completely free from the psychological structure of society, which is to be free of ambition. I say it is entirely possible, but it is not easy. It is a very difficult thing to be free of ambition. Ambition implies the more. The more implies time. And time means arriving, achieving. To deny time is to be free of ambition. I am not talking of chronological time. That you can't deny, for then you will miss your bus. But the psychological time which we have created for ourselves in order to become something inwardly, that you can deny, which means, really, to die to tomorrow without despair. You know, there are clever people, intellectuals, who have examined the outward processes of man. They have examined society with its endless wars. They have examined the churches with their beliefs, dogmas, saviors. And after doing so, they are in despair. Out of despair, they have contrived a philosophy of accepting the immediate, of not thinking about tomorrow, but living as completely as possible in the now. I don't mean that at all. That's very easy. Any materialistic, shallow person can do it, and he doesn't have to be very clever. And that's what most of us do, unfortunately. We live for today, and today is extended into many tomorrows. I don't mean that at all. I mean to deny ambition totally and immediately, to die psychologically to the social structure, so that the mind is never caught in time, in ambition, in the desire to be or not to be something. You know, death is a marvelous thing, and to understand death requires a great deal of insight. To die to ambition, naturally, without effort, to deny envy. Envy implies comparison, success, the pursuit of the more. You have more and I have less. You have a great deal of knowledge and I am ignorant. Can one end this process totally, instantly? One can end it. One can die totally to envy, ambition, competition, only when one is capable of looking at it without any distortion. There is distortion as long as there is motive. When you want to die to ambition in order to be something else, you are still ambitious. That's not dying at all. When you renounce with a motive, it is not renunciation. And inmost renunciations have beyond them this motive to be, to achieve, to arrive, to find. So it seems to me that we are merely becoming more and more clever, better and better informed. We are brought up on words, ideas, theories, knowledge. And there is very little empty space in the mind from which something can be seen clearly. It is only the empty mind that can see clearly, not the mind that's crammed with a lot of information and knowledge, nor the mind that's incessantly active, seeking, achieving, demanding. But a mind that's empty is not just blank. To be aware of an empty mind is extraordinarily difficult, and only in that emptiness is there understanding. Only in that emptiness is their creation. To come to that state of emptiness, one has to deny the whole social structure, the psychological structure of ambition, prestige, power. It is comparatively easy for older people not to be ambitious, to deny power and position. But such denials are very superficial. That's why it is so important to understand the unconscious. To understand the unconscious, that which is hidden and which you don't know, you cannot examine it with a positive, educated, analyzing mind. If you examine the unconscious by the conscious process of analysis, you are bound to create conflict. Do please understand this. It is not very complicated. Our approach to any deep psychological problem is always a positive one. That is, we want to get at it. We want to control or resolve the problem. So we analyze it, or we pursue a particular system in order to understand it. But you can't understand something which you don't know by means of what you already know. You can't dictate what it should or should not be. You must approach it with empty hands. And to have empty hands, or an empty mind, is one of the most difficult things to do. Our minds are so full of the things that we have known. We are burdened with our memories, and every thought is a response of those memories. With positive thought, we approach that which is not positive, the hidden, the unconscious. Now, if without any idea, without expecting to be told how, you can simply listen to what is being said, then I think you will find that you are able to approach the unconscious, which has such power, such an extraordinary drive, compulsion, without creating contradiction, and therefore without effort. You don't have to accept my word for this, and I hope you won't, for then you would make me your authority, which would be a most ugly thing to do. There is the unknowable, something far beyond the mind, beyond all thought. but you cannot possibly approach it with all your knowledge and memories, with the scars of experience, the weight of anxiety, guilt, fear. And you cannot get rid of these things by any effort whatsoever. You can be free of them only by listening to every thought and every feeling without trying to interpret what you hear. Just listen. Just observe and be attentive out of emptiness. Then you can live in this world untouched by its hatred, its ugliness, its brutality. You can function as a clerk, as a bus driver, as a bank manager, or what you will, without being caught in status. But the moment you bring to that function the psychological factors of ambition, authority, power, prestige, you cannot live in this world without everlasting sorrow. Most of us really know all this. One doesn't need at all to listen to a talk of this kind. We know well enough that this is a terrible, brutal, ugly world where every religion, every political faction is trying to shape man's thought, where the welfare state is making us more and more comfortable, dull, stupid, because we have used conflict as a means of becoming outwardly clever, bright. But inwardly, we have not changed at all. We are carrying on as we have been for centuries, fearful, anxious, guilty, seeking power, seeking sex. We are perpetuating what is animalistic, which means that we are still functioning within the psychological structure of society. The question is how to break that structure totally, how to destroy it completely and be out of it, without going insane and without becoming a monk, a nun, or a hermit. That structure can only be broken immediately. There is no time in which to do it. Either you do it immediately or never. Anger. Even at that altitude, the heat was penetrating. The window panes felt warm to the touch. The steady hum of the plane's motor was soothing, and many of the passengers were dozing. The earth was far below us, shimmering in the heat, an unending brown with an occasional patch of green. Presently we landed, and the heat became all but unbearable. It was literally painful, and even in the shade of a building, the top of one's head felt as if it would burst. The summer was well along, and the country was almost a desert. We took off again, and the plane climbed, seeking the cool winds. Two new passengers sat in the opposite seats, and they were talking loudly. It was impossible not to overhear them. They began quietly enough, but soon anger crept into their voices, the anger of familiarity and resentment. In their violence, they seemed to have forgotten the rest of the passengers. They were so upset with each other that they alone existed and no one else. Anger has that peculiar quality of isolation. Like sorrow, it cuts one off, and for the time being, at least, all relationship comes to an end. Anger has the temporary strength and vitality of the isolated. There is a strange despair in anger, for isolation is despair. The anger of disappointment, of jealousy, of the urge to wound, gives a violent release whose pleasure is self-justification. We condemn others, and that very condemnation is a justification of ourselves. Without some kind of attitude, whether of self-righteousness or self-abasement, what are we? We use every means to bolster ourselves up, and anger, like hate, is one of the easiest ways. Simple anger, a sudden flare-up which is quickly forgotten, is one thing. But the anger that is deliberately built up, that has been brewed, and that seeks to hurt and destroy, is quite another matter. Simple anger may have some physiological cause, which can be seen and remedied. But the anger that is the outcome of a psychological cause is much more subtle and difficult to deal with. Most of us do not mind being angry. We find an excuse for it. Why should we not be angry when there is ill treatment of another or of ourselves? So we become righteously angry. We never just say we are angry and stop there. We go into elaborate explanations of its cause. We never just say that we are jealous or bitter, but justify or explain it. We ask how there can be love without jealousy, or say that someone else's actions have made us bitter, and so on. It is the explanation, the verbalization, whether silent or spoken, that sustains anger, that gives it scope and depth. The explanation, silent or spoken, acts as a shield against the discovery of ourselves as we are. We want to be praised or flattered. We expect something. And when these things do not take place, we are disappointed. We become bitter or jealous. Then, violently or softly, we blame someone else. We say the other is responsible for our bitterness. You are of great significance because I depend upon you for my happiness, for my position or prestige. Through you, I fulfill. So you are important to me. I must guard you. I must possess you. Through you, I escape from myself. And when I am thrown back upon myself, being fearful of my own state, I become angry. Anger takes many forms: disappointment, resentment, bitterness, jealousy, and so on. The storing up of anger, which is resentment, requires the antidote of forgiveness. But the storing up of anger is far more significant than forgiveness. Forgiveness is unnecessary when there is no accumulation of anger. Forgiveness is essential if there is resentment. But to be free from flattery and from the sense of injury, without the hardness of indifference, makes for mercy, charity. Anger cannot be got rid of by the action of will, for will is part of violence. Will is the outcome of desire, the craving to lie. And desire in its very nature is aggressive, dominant. To suppress anger by the exertion of will is to transfer anger to a different level, giving it a different name, but it is still part of violence. To be free from violence, which is not the cultivation of nonviolence, there must be the understanding of desire. There is no spiritual substitute for desire. It cannot be suppressed or sublimated. There must be a silent and choiceless awareness of desire. And this passive awareness is the direct experiencing of desire without an experiencer giving it a name. Wherever there is a division, there must be conflict. That's a law, an eternal law. Where there is separation, a division, a breaking up into two parts, there must be conflict. And that conflict exists because we have separated the observer from the observed. I am different from my anger. I am different from my envy. I am different from my sorrow. Therefore, being different, there is conflict. That is, I must get rid of sorrow. Tell me how to overcome sorrow. Tell me what to do with my fear. So there is conflict. Conflict all the time. But you are sorrow. You are not different from sorrow, are you? You are not different from anger, are you? You are not different from your sexual desires, are you? You are not different from the loneliness you feel. You are lonely. Now, before, when I separated, I acted upon my sorrow. You understand? If I am lonely, I then escape from loneliness, try to overcome it or analyze it, and try to fill the loneliness with all kinds of amusements or religious activity. Before, I acted upon it. Now I can't act upon it because I am that. So what happens when the observer is the observed? You understand? When the anger is me, then what takes place? First, all conflict ceases. All conflict ceases when you realize you are that. I am brown. Finished. It's a fact. Light brown or dark brown or purple or whatever color it is. So you eliminate altogether this divisive process which brings conflict in yourself. The fact is, I am anger. I am jealous. I am lonely. Why do we make that into an idea, make an abstraction of it? Is it easier to make an abstraction rather than to face the fact? Because then I can play with the idea. I say, yes, this is a good idea. This is a bad idea. But when there is no abstraction, but the fact, then I have to deal with it. Fear, pleasure, sorrow, thought, and violence are all interrelated. Most of us take pleasure in violence, in disliking somebody, hating a particular race or group of people, having antagonistic feelings toward others. But in a state of mind in which all violence has come to an end, there is a joy which is very different from the pleasure of violence, with its conflicts, hatreds, and fears. Can we go to the very root of violence and be free from it? Otherwise, we shall live everlastingly in battle with each other. If that is the way you want to live, and apparently most people do, then carry on. If you say, well, I'm sorry, violence can never end, then you and I have no means of communication. You have blocked yourself. But if you say there might be a different way of living, then we shall be able to communicate with each other. So let us consider together, those of us who can communicate, whether it is at all possible, totally, to end every form of violence in ourselves, and still live in this monstrously brutal world. I think it is possible. I don't want to have a breath of hate, jealousy, anxiety, or fear in me. I want to live completely at peace, which doesn't mean that I want to die. I want to live on this marvelous earth, so full, so rich, so beautiful. I want to look at the trees, flowers, rivers, meadows, women, boys, and girls, and at the same time live completely at peace with myself and with the world. What can I do? If we know how to look at violence, not only outwardly in society, the wars, the riots, the national antagonisms and class conflicts, but also in ourselves, then perhaps we shall be able to go beyond it. Here is a very complex problem. For centuries upon centuries, man has been violent. Religions have tried to tame him throughout the world, and none of them have succeeded. So if we are going into the question, we must, it seems to me, be at least very serious about it, because it will lead us into quite a different domain. But if we want merely to play with the problem for intellectual entertainment, we shall not get very far. You may feel that you yourself are very serious about the problem. but that as long as so many other people in the world are not serious and are not prepared to do anything about it, what is the good of your doing anything? I don't care whether you take it seriously or not. I take it seriously. That is enough. I am not my brother's keeper. I, myself, as a human being, feel very strongly about this question of violence, and I will see to it that in myself I am not violent. But I cannot tell you or anybody else, don't be violent. It has no meaning, unless you yourself want it. So if you yourself really want to understand this problem of violence, let us continue on our journey of exploration together. Is this problem of violence out there or here? Do you want to solve the problem in the outside world, or are you questioning violence itself as it is in you? If you are free of violence in yourself, the question is, how am I to live in a world full of violence, acquisitiveness, greed, envy, brutality? Will I not be destroyed? That is the inevitable question, which is invariably asked. When you ask such a question, it seems to me you are not actually living peacefully. If you live peacefully, you will have no problem at all. You may be imprisoned because you refuse to join the army, or shot because you refuse to fight. But that is not a problem. You will be shot. It is extraordinarily important to understand this. We are trying to understand violence as a fact, not as an idea, as a fact which exists in the human being, and the human being is myself. And to go into the problem, I must be completely vulnerable, open to it. I must expose myself to myself, not necessarily expose myself to you, because you may not be interested, but I must be in a state of mind that demands to see this thing right to the end, and at no point stops and says, I will go no further. Now, it must be obvious to me that I am a violent human being. I have experienced violence in anger, violence in my sexual demands, violence in hatred, creating enmity, violence in jealousy, and so on. I have experienced it. I have known it. And I say to myself, I want to understand this whole problem, not just one fragment of it expressed in war, but this aggression in man, which also exists in the animals, and of which I am a part. Violence is not merely killing another. It is violence when we use a sharp word, when we make a gesture to brush away a person, when we obey because there is fear. So violence isn't merely organized butchery in the name of God, in the name of society or country. Violence is much more subtle, much deeper, and we are inquiring into the very depths of violence. When you call yourself an Indian or a Muslim or a Christian or a European or anything else, you are being violent. Do you see why it is violent? Because you are separating yourself from the rest of mankind. When you separate yourself by belief, by nationality, by tradition, it breeds violence. So a man who is seeking to understand violence does not belong to any country, to any religion, to any political party or partial system. He is concerned with the total understanding of mankind. There are two primary schools of thought with regard to violence. One which says violence is innate in man, and the other which says violence is the result of the social and cultural heritage in which man lives. We are not concerned with which school we belong to. It is of no importance. What is important is the fact that we are violent, not the reason for it. One of the most common expressions of violence is anger. When my wife or sister is attacked, I say I am righteously angry. When my country is attacked, my ideas, my principles, my way of life, I am righteously angry. I am also angry when my habits are attacked, or my petty little opinions. When you tread on my toes or insult me, I get angry. Or if you run away with my wife and I get jealous, that jealousy is called righteous, because she is my property. And all this anger is morally justified. But to kill for my country is also justified. So when we are talking about anger, which is a part of violence, do we look at anger in terms of righteous and unrighteous anger, according to our own inclinations and environmental drive, or do we see only anger? Is there righteous anger ever, or is there only anger? There is no good influence or bad influence, only influence. But when you are influenced by something which doesn't suit me, I call it an evil influence. The moment you protect your family, your country, a bit of colored rag called a flag, a belief, an idea, a dogma, the thing that you demand or that you hold, that very protection indicates anger. So can you look at anger without any explanation or justification, without saying, I must protect my goods, or I was right to be angry, or how stupid of me to be angry? Can you look at anger as if it were something by itself? Can you look at it completely objectively, which means neither defending it nor condemning it? Can you? Can I look at you if I am antagonistic to you, or if I am thinking what a marvelous person you are? I can see you only when I look at you with a certain care, in which neither of these things is involved. Now, can I look at anger in the same way, which means that I am vulnerable to the problem? I do not resist it. I am watching this extraordinary phenomenon without any reaction to it. It is very difficult to look at anger dispassionately because it is a part of me, but that is what I am trying to do. Here I am, a violent human being, whether I am black, brown, white, or purple. I am not concerned with whether I have inherited this violence or whether society has produced it in me. All I am concerned with is whether it is at all possible to be free from it. To be free from violence means everything to me. It is more important to me than sex, food, position. For this thing is corrupting me. It is destroying me and destroying the world. And I want to understand it. I want to be beyond it. I feel responsible for all this anger and violence in the world. I feel responsible. It isn't just a lot of words. And I say to myself, I can do something only if I am beyond anger myself, beyond violence, beyond nationality. This feeling I have that I must understand the violence in myself brings tremendous vitality and passion to find out. To investigate the fact of your own anger, you must pass no judgment on it. For the moment you conceive of its opposite, you condemn it, and therefore you cannot see it as it is. When you say you dislike or hate someone, that is a fact, although it sounds terrible. If you look at it, go into it completely, it ceases. But if you say, I must not hate, I must have love in my heart, then you are living in a hypocritical world with double standards. To live completely, fully in the moment, is to live with what is, the actual, without any sense of condemnation or justification. Then you understand it so totally that you are finished with it. When you see clearly, the problem is solved. What is analysis? Analysis is observation, isn't it? A form of observation. I watch, and watching myself, I say, I have been angry. Why have I been angry? The explanations, the cause, the justifications, all that is part of analysis, which is part of thought, isn't it? And analysis takes time. At the end of it, I say, that anger was justified, or that anger was not justified. Therefore, I must be watchful next time. I will only get angry when it is justified, righteous anger and unrighteous anger. So look what is happening. Thought is awakened to anger and watching anger. Then what takes place? The thought is the observer, isn't it? Then the observer is different from the thing which it observes, his anger. In observing thought and all the activities of thought, out of that observation comes intelligence. This intelligence is the result of observation of the workings of thought. Now, that intelligence is watching, watching the mind, watching the body, watching the heart. That intelligence says, don't eat that food. Listen to this, because yesterday you had pain. Give it up. And because intelligence is in operation, you give it up instantly. Questioner. That's memory, sir. Krishnamurti. No, wait, listen carefully. I said, sir, intelligence is not thought. Intelligence comes into being in observing the operation of thought. Observing, not condemning it or accepting it, just watching thought, how thought operates. In that watching, intelligence comes. Now, that intelligence is watching, and I eat the wrong things. When that intelligence is watching, listen to it. It's also aware of the causation, which is the past. So intelligence doesn't neglect the cause. It is aware of the cause and the result. But it is not memory. It is intelligence, which perceives the whole movement of causation. Look, I am angry. That's the only factor, isn't it? When I say I must not be angry, that's a conclusion. That's an abstraction. But the fact is, I'm angry. If I know how to resolve that anger, its opposite wouldn't arise. Can I solve that anger without resorting to its opposite, saying, I must not be angry? The I must not be angry is its opposite. And that comes only when I can't understand the whole structure of anger and go beyond it. So I say, can I understand anger, not control it, not reject it, not yield to it, but understand it, have an insight into the whole structure of anger? If I do, then the opposite doesn't exist. Questioner. If I don't control my anger, I'm afraid I'll kill someone. Krishnamurti. Look, before you kill somebody, try to find out if you can resolve the anger. To control it is to suppress it. To say, I must not be angry, is to create the opposite, and therefore a conflict between must not be and the fact that I am. Or, if you try to escape from it, anger is still there. Look what has taken place. Before, I tried to control it, which is a wastage of energy. Before, I tried to suppress it, which is a wastage of energy. Before, I tried to escape from it or rationalize it, which is an avoidance, an escape from the fact. If I don't escape, control, suppress, or try to rationalize it, all that energy is concentrated, isn't it? So I have got that enormous energy to deal with one fact, which is anger. Have you got that? Please, otherwise we can't go on. If you haven't got it, then it becomes merely verbal. You understand? You're angry. Your tradition, your culture, says suppress it, control it, escape from it, and rationalize it. I say that is wasting your energy, which prevents you from observing the only factor, which is anger. So anger has no opposite. There is only that, and you have the energy. Now, next step. Why do you call it anger? Because previously you have been angry. By naming it as anger, you have emphasized the previous experience. So you are observing the present factor with the previous experience, therefore conditioning the present factor. Are you meeting this? So the naming is a wastage of energy. So you do not name. No control, no suppression, no escape, and you have the energy. Then, is there anger? Don't say you don't know, because you are then facing the only factor. And when you are facing completely that factor, the factor doesn't exist, because it exists only when you are escaping, fighting, controlling, suppressing. Right? You've got it? There is in me, in a human being, this duality. And I ask myself, is there a duality at all? There is man, woman, sunshine, darkness. That's obvious. But psychologically, are there opposites? This requires attention, doesn't it? Because to see this clearly, you need to observe. Freedom is not a reaction, but rather the state of mind which comes into being when we understand reaction. Reaction is the response to challenge. It is pleasure, anger, fear, psychological pain. And in understanding this very complex structure of response, we shall come upon freedom. Then you will find that freedom is not freedom from anger, from authority, and so on. It is a state per se, to be experienced for itself, and not because you are against something. Guilt. What is guilt? And what is its relationship to the ego, the whole consciousness of humankind, of man, of woman? And so on. What is guilt? Why does one have this enormous sense of guilt? It may be very, very superficial, or very, very deep-rooted from childhood, and allowed to grow as one gets older. And that feeling of guilt makes one feel very empty. You know all this, with a sense of not being able to do anything. And then, out of that guilt, one builds a wall round himself. And that wall prevents any further communication. Or I am frightened of that guilt. You have told me to do something from childhood, and I can't do it. But I feel I must do it, and if I fail, I feel guilty. And the parents play a terrible role in this. Sorry. They encourage this guilt, consciously or unconsciously, so that this guilt becomes part of the ego, part of me. I think it would be wrong to put the question, what is the relationship between the two? You understand how the question is evolving? It is not two separate things. It is the outcome of feeling guilt, with other factors that constitute the ego. They are not two separate activities or two separate reactions. So guilt is part of the psyche, part of the ego, part of the me. Now, why does one feel guilt? People make you feel guilty and hold you in that state because it's very convenient for them. They like to bully you and bring about a sense of guilt, the feeling that you must submit, you must accept, you must obey. Though you revolt against it, you keep it underground and hold on to your guilt. And other factors make up the ego, the me. Guilt makes one feel terribly lonely, with a sense of depression. And if that guilt is very deep and strong, one can't resolve it. Therefore, I come to you and say, please help me to overcome this guilt. And then you impose, if you are the boss, another reaction of guilt. So it goes on. I am asking, we are asking, why does this feeling exist at all? It is encouraged, isn't it? In Orthodox religions, in Christianity, there is the original sin and the Savior, and therefore I must feel guilty, and confession and the whole circus begins. Forgive me if I use that word. It takes different forms. In the Christian world, confession, absolution, and in the Asiatic world, it has a different form. They go to temples, you know, all kinds of things they do. But is it necessary to feel that? Can there be an education in which there is nothing of this? I wonder. We are playing together, please. Is there a kind of bringing up a child in which there is not this encouragement of the feeling of guilt? How to resolve guilt, how to get over it, becomes a problem. All kinds of things begin with it, and we make it into a problem. Now, what is a problem? Human beings apparently have thousands of problems, political, religious, economic, sexual, in relationship. Life, living, becomes a problem, and part of it is generally associated with guilt. Is it possible not to have a single problem? Sexual, religious, political, economic, in relationship, and so on. So let's find out. You are playing the game with me. Let's find out why human beings have problems. From childhood, when a child goes to school, writing becomes a problem to him. Reading, spelling, then mathematics, geography, history, biology, chemistry, science, archaeology, and so on. So from the very beginning, he is trained or conditioned to have problems. This is obvious. So his brain is conditioned to have problems. Are you playing the game with me? And all his life, from the moment he is born, practically until he dies, the brain continues to live in problems, because he has been educated, cultivated in the whole system of comparison, examinations, rewards, punishments, and so on. All that has made the brain not only receive problems, but have its own problems. It's conditioned that way. Therefore, it can never solve any problem. So is it possible to have a brain that has no problems, but can answer problems? Because there are problems. Now, is that possible? Because as long as you have problems, you must have the feeling that you must resolve them. And if you can't resolve them, you feel guilty. And so, we keep this going. Then others come and help us, and the whole thing begins again in a different form. Listen to the question. Go into the mechanism of guilt, its relation to the ego. And we said, don't separate the two, because guilt is part of the ego, part of the me. It's not separate. Therefore, it's not something related to. It is in. It is there. Then we said, why do we have problems? Problems exist from childhood, from the child who goes to the school. He is educated to have problems. So his whole life becomes a problem. Depression, anxiety, and so on. Then he goes and asks another, which means asking help from another. But the other is himself. The other has problems, gets depressed, feels lonely. So the other is you. I wonder if you realize this. Therefore, what's the good of asking him? Questioner, I have done something wrong and sinful, and it has left me with a terrible feeling of guilt. How am I to get over this feeling? Krishnamurti, sir, what do you mean by sin? The Christians have a concept of sin, which you have not. But you do feel guilty when you have more money, when you have a bigger house than somebody else. At least you should. Laughter. When you are riding in a comfortable car, and you see a queue of people 1 mile long waiting to catch a bus, it does something to you. Either you have what is called a feeling of guilt, or you want to transform something radically, not in the stupid economic sense, but in the religious sense, so that these things cannot happen in the world. Or you may feel guilty because you realize that you have a certain capacity, an insight which others have not. But strangely, we never feel guilty about such things. We feel guilty only about worldly things, having more money, a better social position, and so on. Now, what is this sense of guilt, and when are you aware of it? Is it a form of pity? Most of us are occupied with ourselves in different ways from morning till night, and consciously or unconsciously, we move along in that stream. When there is a sudden challenge, that movement of self-occupation is disturbed, and then we feel guilty. We feel that we are doing something wrong, or that we have not done something right. But that feeling is still within the stream of self-centered activity, is it not? I do not know if you are all following this. Why should you feel guilty? If you are living intensely with your whole being, if you are fully aware of everything about you and within yourself, the unconscious as well as the conscious, where is there room for guilt? It is the man who lives in fragments, who is divided within himself, that feels guilty. One part of him is good, the other part corrupt. One part is trying to be noble, and the other is ignoble. One part is ambitious, ruthless, and the other part talks about peace, love. Such people feel guilty because they are still within the pattern of their own making. As long as there is self-centered activity, you cannot get over the feeling of guilt. It is impossible. That feeling disappears only when you approach life totally, with your whole being, that is, when there is no self-fulfillment of any kind. Then you will find that the sense of guilt does not exist at all, because you are not thinking about yourself. There is no self-centered activity. Sirs, if you are listening and are not acting, it is like a man who is always tilling and never sowing. It is better not to listen to a truth than to listen without acting, for then it becomes a poison. Whether you approve or disapprove of the details of what is said here is irrelevant. What matters is to see the truth that as long as you function within the field of self-centered activity, you are bound to have various kinds of sorrow and frustration. Sorrow and frustration cease only when you are living totally with the intensity of your whole being, of your mind, heart, and body. And you cannot live with that completeness, with that intensity, if you are concerned about your own virtue. You may be free from the feeling of guilt today, but it will arise in another form tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. Just try this, sirs. Try a little bit to live intensely every day with all your mind, heart, and body, with all your capacity, feeling, energy. Desire is contradictory in itself, but if you love intensely with your body, mind, and heart, with everything that you have, then you will find there is no contradiction. There is no sin. It is desire, envy, ambition that creates contradiction. And the mind caught in contradiction can never find that which is real. I feel guilt. Why do I name it? I name it instantly. The naming of it is the recognition of it. Therefore, I have had that feeling before. And having had it before, I recognize it now. Through recognition, I strengthen what has happened before. I have strengthened the memory of the previous guilt by saying, I feel guilty. So, see what has happened. Every form of recognition strengthens the past. And recognition takes place through naming. So, by and through recognition, I strengthen the past. Why does the mind do this? Why does it always strengthen the past by saying, I have been guilty, I am guilty, it is terrible to be guilty. How am I to get rid of this guilt? Why does it do it? Does it do it because the mind needs to be occupied with something? It needs to be occupied, whether with God, with smoke, with sex, with something. It has to be occupied. Therefore, it is afraid not to be occupied. And in occupation with the feeling of guilt, in that feeling, there is a certain security. At least I have that thing. I have nothing else, but at least I have that feeling of being guilty. So what is happening? Through recognition, which is the naming, the mind is strengthening a past feeling, which has happened before. And so the mind is constantly occupied with that feeling of guilt. That gives it a certain occupation, a certain sense of security, a certain action from that which becomes neurotic. So what takes place? Can I, when the feeling arises, observe it without naming? So I find when I do not name, the thing no longer exists. And I am afraid, listen to this carefully, the mind is afraid of living in a state of nothingness. Therefore, it has to have a word. The word has become tremendously important. My country, my God, my Jesus, my Krishna. The word. So the word, listen to this, the word is the past. The word is the memory. The word is the thought. So thought divides. Look, I must have memory in order to go to my house. I must have memory to talk English. I must have memory to come here and sit on this platform. I must have memory for the language that I use. I have memory of riding a bicycle or driving a car. So memory is absolutely essential, otherwise I couldn't function. Memory is knowledge. We must have knowledge. And that knowledge, listen to what takes place, that knowledge is words. Now, I have had the knowledge of previous guilt. When I call the present feeling guilt, I have strengthened the previous knowledge. And that knowledge is the observer. So the observer looks at that feeling, which I have now, and calls it guilt. And therefore, in calling it guilt, the knowledge of the past is strengthened. It is fairly simple and clear. Questioner, who is the observer? Is the observer different from the many fragments? Krishnamurti, he is one of the fragments, isn't he? Q. But the feeling of myself is there. K. I know it is there. That is the illusion. Wait, sir. That is our culture. That is our verbal statement. That is the way we live. We say, I have identified myself with my country, with my God, with my flag, my politics, and so on. I have been identifying with all those. And I say, how stupid of me. That has led to a lot of mischief. Now I want to identify with myself. You see, I have discarded all the identification outside of me. Now I want to identify myself with myself. What is myself? It is obviously a lot of images and words. And so I say, look at what I am doing. I am always trying to establish a fact, which becomes a non-fact, always trying to defend myself with an idea, with an image, with a conclusion, and those are all words. The mind is afraid of being completely empty. Therefore, it says, I must be. It is so afraid of being empty. Therefore, it must be occupied with the kitchen, with sex, with God, with politics, with a dozen things, because it is so afraid to be completely empty. The observer is the past, and the observed is the present. Now, can the mind observe without naming the feeling, which is the present?